Blog Talk Radio.
And thanks. Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluwa Mi, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Araba Mi, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Ode Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe-o.
Ashe-o. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by New Power Radio Network and the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights. We ask that you please support our sponsors, Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by my co-host on Wednesday nights, Dr. James Jones. You can find him on Facebook as James Jones, as well as Manhood, Race, and Culture, and on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Also, please support Arlie Gordon of Unity Design. You can find him on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com, and Unity is spelled UNITEE. And last but not least, we want to please ask that you support the gathering and the creation of a Black Treasury through AAES, which is All African Empowerment Society. You can find them on the World Wide Web at aaesociety.org. And, of course, we want to keep our brothers and sisters behind enemy lines in our thoughts and prayers. Please reach out.
Implicit bias is the embedding of negative stereotypes and associations in our brains around groups. When we talk about identity difference, what we're talking about is a set of hierarchies when it comes to race or gender or sexuality. We take in so many culture cues over our lifespan that help us create these hierarchies of human value. What implicit bias is the embedding of those stereotypes in relationship to a hierarchy that operate in very quick, automatic periods in our brain. Racial anxiety is the feeling that we have in the middle of an interracial interaction when race drops into the conversation. So if you were white and all of a sudden the conversation turns towards race, you may worry that whatever you say next will make you be perceived as a racist. If you are of color and race drops in the conversation, you are worried that whatever comes next may invalidate your life experience and that you won't be seen fairly or truthfully. When that happens, your executive brains, both executive brains, are literally shutting down. They're going into fight or flight mode, and you cannot have a meaningful conversation or interaction when both brains are butting up against each other. So our answer to that typically is avoidance, right? We run away from the conversation. The other alternative is to build up the intensity of that fight situation and go at it. We believe that understanding what underlies racial anxiety, understanding that race is not just a social construct, but also a physiological and an emotional construct, is something that is critical to helping us move forward and having more meaningful conversations around race.
Members of the Ohio State University community believe that diversity is an important institutional goal. We also recognize that unconscious biases influence behaviors even when people have the very best intentions. Even when they understand how important diversity is to the reasons we are here, enriching student learning and making breakthroughs in research. So what are these unconscious biases and how do they operate? Let's peel back a layer and look at schemas. We all, regardless of gender or race, perceive and treat people based on their race, gender, social group, etc. We have expectations, judgments, hypotheses, oftentimes unconscious, that influence how we see people. These are our schemas. An unconscious bias is at play when someone says, relatively few qualified minority candidates are available, and these are highly sought after, so we're unlikely to recruit them. Schemas can lead us to faulty reasoning that is not supported by available data. There are, in fact, qualified minority candidates, and bias prevents them from being hired in the proportion available. Let's look at some examples of how schemas or biases limit applicant pools in recruitment and selection processes. When evaluating identical application packages, male and female university psychology professors preferred 2-to-1 to hire Brian over Karen as an assistant professor. When evaluating a more experienced record at the point of promotion to tenure, reservations were expressed 4 times more often when the name was female. Letters of recommendation are critical to securing jobs and securing promotion, and bias is prevalent. Letters for men tend to be longer and contain more references to the applicant's CV, publications, patients, and colleagues. The letters for women, on the other hand, are shorter and contain more references to personal life and more doubt raisers such as hedges, faint praise, and irrelevancies. Statements like these appear in letters. It's amazing how much she's accomplished. It appears her health is stable. She's close to my wife. One male instructor provided a guest lecture to 8 sections of a communication course. In half the lectures, he referred to my partner Jennifer. In the other half, to my partner Jason. The straight instructor received 22% more positive comments than the gay instructor. The straight instructor received 81% fewer negative comments than the gay instructor. Applicants with names that are more likely to be perceived as African American had to send 15 resumes to get a callback, compared with 10 needed by applicants with white-sounding names. White names yield as many more callbacks as an additional 8 years of experience. Biases influence the rate at which the inventions of faculty women are commercialized and lead to startup companies. Male academics are much more likely than their female counterparts to start companies to exploit their inventions. In an experiment to see whether tech licensing officers in leading research universities favor the inventions of male inventors, identical invention proposals were sent out, half with a female name and half with a male name. Although the inventions were identical, the licensing officers were significantly more likely to dissuade the female inventor from starting a company. In a study in the American Journal of Sociology using identical applications, evaluators rated mothers as less competent and committed to paid work than women who were not mothers. Prospective employers called mothers back about half as often as those who are not mothers. Mothers were less likely to be recommended for hire, promotion, and management, and were offered lower starting salaries than women who were not mothers. Fathers were not disadvantaged in the hiring process. Fathers were seen as more committed to paid work and offered higher starting salaries than men who were not fathers. So how can we chip away at pervasive schemas and achieve a diverse faculty of outstanding scholars and teachers who represent different genders, cultures, races, ethnicities, backgrounds, and work and life experiences? Biases hide in plain sight. They are prevalent and appear in our everyday interactions and decisions. This video presentation was the first step in building your awareness of unconscious biases. Be mindful of them as you serve on selection and promotion and tenure committees. Write letters of support, interact with your colleagues and students, and serve the university in all the many ways that you do.
I would like to begin my talk with an important message. You know, like the ones for the pharmaceutical companies when they see people walking lazily along the beach or running in slow motion through fields of flowers where they tell you the side effects of their product? Nausea, vomiting, heart arrhythmia, constipation, impotence. Erections lasting more than 4 hours. But seriously, I'm going to say some things during my talk that may make you uncomfortable, and they should. But what I ask of you in this time is to stay present with me through this and ask yourself some critical questions, to really listen closer and ask and really question your own thoughts and behaviors and be open to a new view of yourself. You may ask as I start to present this, You may say, oh, Melanie, I got that. I know this. I read the book. This doesn't apply to me. I would like to challenge that belief. And you may say, what is this concept that is so controversial that she feels she needs a preface statement? The concept is implicit bias. Let me tell you a story. A young couple, college sweethearts, they graduate school, begin their careers, get married, and start a family. As they start to approach their 30s, they begin to say that they're closing in on the American dream. They purchase their first home. 3 weeks after they close on this home, the husband becomes violently ill. So this family, husband, wife, three children, ages 5, 3, and 1, and a baby on the way, goes searching for the diagnosis that has stricken this otherwise healthy and vital 32-year-old man. Turn to your neighbor and say, 4 weeks later. As this man lays critically ill and dying in a hospital, doctors are circling around a cluster of diseases that they know must be the thing that is killing this man, despite that the fact that all the tests for these diseases have come back negative. They begin to harass the husband and ask him to tell the truth and to really open up and let them know about his IV drug use and his secret unprotected sex with men. You see, they were trying to make the case to continue looking for HIV despite multiple negative tests. Finally, the wife comes and says, "Why? What are you looking for?" To which the doctors reply, "We're looking for HIV and sarcoidosis." So the wife, kind of perplexed because we thought we'd already ruled those things, they thought they'd already ruled those things out, says, "Well, why are you looking at only those diseases?" To which the doctors say, "Well, as a young African-American male," she becomes irate and says, "Stop right there. I want you to check my husband for things that white people get." And magically, within days, they have a diagnosis. Stage 4B non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and a prognosis, 2 weeks to live. The implicit bias that existed within these doctors resulted in the behavior that showed what diseases they chose to and not to look for. The implicit bias of these doctors said how much value they placed or did not place upon the information that they received from the patient and his wife. You may say, Melanie, how does this happen? How do we as good activists and hardworking, progressive, open-minded American citizens, how do we continue to fall into the story of these stereotypes? Implicit bias, those unconscious things that have been flowing through us since childhood. You may say to me, well, what is implicit bias? Well, I'm going to give you an academic definition. Implicit bias, otherwise known as implicit social cognition, are those attitudes and stereotypes that affect our behaviors, our decisions, and our attitudes unconsciously. I relate it to like the Matrix. Anyone here seen the Matrix? When you're in the Matrix, you don't know you're in there. You're just happily walking along, thinking everything is okay. Well, I'm here today to yank out the plug and disconnect you from the mainframe. Let me share with you another story. There's picture it. I feel like Sophia Petrillo. Picture it. Fourth grade math class. A teacher asks for volunteers to go up to the board to work on long division. One young girl and two of her friends go up and they start working on the board. The little girl is the first one done. Since she's the first one done, she starts checking her answer and looking over, and now that she's very convinced that she's gotten the right answer, she waves to the teacher to check her work. That she hears a sound from the back of the room. The answer is wrong. Check it again. The girl, quite perplexed, because she checked it twice and she knew it was right. She goes back to the board and she checks her computations again, getting the same answer. So she goes back to the teacher and says, Teacher, I know it's right. I checked it 3 times. Now at this point, the teacher, being very stern, sharply says, I said it's wrong. Check it again. Now the girl is thoroughly perplexed. It's math. It's either it's right or it's wrong. So she goes to her desk where she has a calculator. So she starts working on her computation, and it's the same one as is on the board. So now she's thoroughly convinced. She said the teacher cannot say anything. So she holds up her calculator and says, "Teacher, teacher, look, I got it right all the way to the thousandth place." Now this teacher, thoroughly upset that this student continuing to challenge her, says, "I said the answer is wrong. You niggers can't do anything right." The student is struck dumb by the words that just hit her like a cannon. She didn't understand. Why is the teacher saying this to her? I don't understand. Why is this happening? Her father was a mathematician with a PhD from a prestigious university. She had learned long division in first grade and a different method for doing it. She didn't understand. Why was her teacher saying this to her? This little girl learned the first of many valuable lessons that day. First, she learned that her teacher did not see her as a gifted student. Two, her teacher didn't see her as the child of educated parents. The teacher did not even see a correct math problem on the board. Some people may say this one was a raging racist that only saw the child as an uppity nigga who could not conform and do right. But what I'd like to offer to you today is another frame. Could it be that this teacher, her implicit bias had so ingrained to her that blacks were intellectually inferior and unintelligent that it was impossible for a child in an urban school to not only get the problem correct, but do it in a different method? So then when faced with something that all her life, that her biases had told her was impossible, that could not possibly be, reacted from such a primal place to protect that worldview that she had held sacred up until that time. There's another quote. Some people just not ready to be unplugged. They are so inured, so dependent on the system as it stands that they will fight to protect it. Again, the matrix, that's Morpheus. Implicit biases are pervasive. We all have them. Even people with avowed commitments to impartiality, like let's say judges. Now you may say to me, "Melanie, these are wild stories. These are extreme examples. We're good people. Good people don't do these things. That can't be real." Let me tell you today, this is very real. I'm going to share a piece of information with you about these stories that's going to tell you how real they are. These are both stories out of my life. In the first story, I was the wife who, big and pregnant, as my mother said, big with child, had to fight to get people to check my husband for things that white people got. And the implicit biases, those doctors could have left a woman without a husband, children without a father, and a mother without a son. I was the gifted fourth grade student in the second story. In that story, in the end, it led to my first act of nonviolent social protest. I stayed to sit in for 100 days in my living room. Now, just so I'm going to share one more story with you, just so you can understand that this, you may say, "Well, Melanie, you're kind of old. And, you know, these things may have happened long ago in the land far, far away, like Tatooine, you know. But I just want to let you know that this happens right here in River City." So this September, a beautiful, gifted African-American ninth grade girl enters school. Because she'd been in a honors program, she entered ninth grade with enough credits to technically be a 10th grader. Now, this young lady has a goal. Her goal is to go to Cornell and study neuroscience. She has had this goal for many years, and all the people in her circles, you know, nurture her in this goal and make opportunities for her to start to build the building blocks to make her goal a reality. So as she enters ninth grade, she goes to meet the guidance counselor, as ninth graders do. And as guidance counselors do, she sits down with the student and says, "Well, what is your goal?" And as this young lady, she's very confident as 14-year-old girls can be. You know how that is. You know, she goes and says, I want to go to Cornell and be a neuroscientist. To which her guidance counselor reacts, well, that's a big dream, but let's look at something more realistic, like MCC. In that moment, the student stood stunned as she watched her goal crumble. And people may say, well, Melanie, he's just one person, but he's so much more than that. He was the guidance counselor. In the schools, just so you know, the guidance counselor is the person who is charged with setting the academic plan to help students get from point A to point B to get to their goals. So if he didn't believe in her, how was he going to help her? And if he didn't help her, how was she going to attain her goal? This was the match that ignited a forest fire of self-doubt, negative self-talk that resulted in depression that manifested itself in school avoidance, of decreasing grades, and eventual lack of ability to engage in the everyday life for this child. You know what the ironic thing is about this story? This is my daughter's story. 40 years later, the words may have changed, but the bias, the power, and the potential impact remain the same. But you know what's even worse about that? Is that my daughter's story is not unique. This story repeats itself hundreds of times every year in the Rochester City School District for hundreds of students going in with dreams and goals. And the thing is, the counselor did not look at my child and did not look at her academic record, but just because of what he saw when she walked in, crushed her dream. But I don't want to leave you on a downer, and I'm going to tell you there is hope. Because what has been done can be undone. Our brains are malleable. They're these incredible, even though my brain is farting right now, they are incredible. They are these incredible capacity for growth and change. And so you may say to me, Melanie, how do I do this? First, what I want you to do is to call yourself on your own stuff. When you're walking down the street and you see that person coming and you cross over to the other side of the street, call yourself on it. Ask yourself, why did I do that? What did that person do to facilitate that response from me? And then once you've done that and you start looking at yourself, I don't want you to think I don't understand that this takes you being extremely self-aware. But once you do that, you start having these conversations with your family and friends. It's very easy to have these conversations in the nice, warm, fuzzy places of a TED Talk, but it's much more and it's much different to have it at your Sunday dinner with your mother-in-law. Okay? What we're looking for, we say we want to be better. But in order for us to have this better world we're talking about, we must be better ourselves and be better to each other. We have to move into what I call transformational activism. In order to create a world with equity, we must do some things. First, do your own personal work. Two, make some connections with people that don't look like you. Three, when you have privilege, use your privilege to create equity. And guess what? Many of you in this room have it. Use it. And four, intentionally and deliberately engage in non-biasing activities. That means get out of homogeneous groups, get into some heterogeneous groups where not everybody's the same, and start learning some stuff. Take that stuff and share it with others. I want to leave you with some new language. Ubuntu. It's a Nigeri Bantu word that translates into the idea of I am who I am because of who we all are. And we are who we are because of who I am. It talks about the interconnectedness of us all. It is one step beyond I am my brother or sister's keeper. It is I am my brother and sister and they are me. I see you, I see myself. When you look at yourself next time, see me.
Our problem is that the new American dilemma isn't so simple. We have all of these markers by which we can demonstrate that we're not the people we used to be. But we don't know the ways in which we're not such good people because that part is unconscious. You may think this about yourself, but is that really who you are? We actually created a test that measures bias. You see words that capture good and bad. You have to associate Yankees with good and Red Sox with bad. This is very easy for a Yankee fan. But when you tell them to associate Yankee with bad and Red Sox with good, that's an impossible thing for them to do. They can't do it. They'll make mistakes. They'll take a lot longer to do it, and so on. Take a test like this and now just replace Red Sox and Yankees with the groups black and white. Imagine that for half the trials on this test, you have to associate black with good whenever you see a black face or a word like love, peace, joy, friend, all these good things. And while you're doing that, you have to put white and bad together and words that mean terrible things in the world, words like agony, devil, bomb, vomit. How hard is that for you to do, is the question. We're not talking about your conscious attitudes. We're not talking about your conscious beliefs. We're talking about something that you yourself may not necessarily know you have. For something like 75% of white Americans, it's very hard to put black and good together.
Put this on YouTube.
Yeah.
You heard this, dude.
I believe our greatest need as a people is to educate our youth. I believe that we need to move from all of the individuals and groups who are doing great things in their communities to uplift kids through better education, but we need to move from fragmentation to consolidation to coalition. They are simply products that help to create awareness.
Anytime you can put a symbol on a t-shirt that symbolizes unity, that's what we're doing.
Something for people to rally around. I use the colors of red, black, and green to reconnect African American youth with their culture. How do you know where you're going if you don't know where you've been and what you've been through as a people? At best, we are strongest together. And in that sense, I am driven and passionate about talking to as many people and groups all over this country who, again, want to help to maximize the mission, want to help to move forward our kids with better educational opportunities.
Hello, my name is Dr. James Thomas Jones III, and I am the author of a new and exciting book titled Foolish Floyd, The Life and Times of an African-American Contrarian. Now, I'm certain that you know someone like Floyd, 50-something years old from Greenwood, Mississippi, who has all of the answers to Black America's problems, if only we would stop being so stubborn and listen to him. Let me give you a sample of the wit and wisdom that one receives from Foolish Floyd. When told that he was an African-American, Floyd responded, "I'm black, ain't never been to no damn Africa, and neither have you." When I asked Floyd to go and testify about a brutal crime that he had seen committed in his community, his response was, "Let's say that I do go and tell the police who did it. Hell, everyone in the Fifth Ward knows who did it. That ain't no big secret. The next thing you know, old Floyd is going to be down at the police station picking these bastards out of the lineup. Then I have to go to court and testify against them in public. The entire time, I'm living next door to their people. No, sir, I will pass on getting my head blown off. Let someone else play the hero. I would rather be alive. If you think that you would like to read more about Floyd, please visit Amazon.com and purchase a copy of Foolish Floyd, The Life and Times of an African-American Contrarian. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Can everyone hear me okay? Can you hear me okay? All right, excellent. So thank you so much for being here. For the entire 8 years that I've been at Google, I've been in a team called People Analytics, and you can essentially think of us as the software engineers behind HR. We ensure that every decision that we make on the HR side is infused with data, analytics, and research. Without those things, nothing gets done at Google. And so just about a year ago, we tackled a question very different from the questions that we've been tackling up until that point. And we wanted to find out, how do people make decisions? And are they always making the best decisions? We all know we're working with intelligent people. We're in an incredible industry. Is it possible that we're making suboptimal decisions, especially when it comes to people decisions? Now, this inquiry was prompted by a study that was covered in the New York Times. And it's the kind of study you would have expected to have been run like in 1971 or something like that. Some professors created some resumes, two resumes. They were identical in all ways, but one had a man's name on the top of it. The other had a woman's name on the top of it. They sent these resumes to their colleagues. So think about the audience here. These were professors at the best universities in the United States. They were reviewing resumes for the kind of job that they would be hiring for, which is the manager of a science lab, which they all had. And their job was simply to evaluate the credentials of the person that they were reviewing. Is this somebody that you'd want to hire? How competent will they be? How hireable are they? Would you like to mentor that person? All the data came back, and the 1971 finding came through, which is they were much more likely to say the resume with a man's name on it was a more competent candidate, a more hireable candidate, and they would, on average, pay that candidate more than the exact same candidate with the exact same resume but with a female name to it. So that made us take a step back. It's like, are we still living in that world today? And then the immediate response was, maybe in some parts of the world, but here in high tech with super smart people, we probably don't have to worry about it too much. And then I walked outside and I noticed on the side of a New York City bus the advertisement for this new HBO show called Silicon Valley. Does anybody notice anything weird about that? There are no women in that advertisement whatsoever. So this is the world's view of Silicon Valley. And there is some truth to it in the sense that if we look at all of the venture-backed U.S. companies, startups in the United States, only 11% are headed by women or were founded by women. 11%, which makes total sense because women are only 11% of the population. Or you might say, only 11% of all great ideas come from women. Like, we know both of those things are not true. So what we want to do is understand, how does this happen, right? So what role do we play in making this happen? So to tell that story, we're going to start at the beginning. And this beginning is hundreds of thousands of years ago. Right, so this is us when we were a new species and we were living in hunter-gatherer societies. We were huddled together in caves. We were making really pretty paintings. But the world was different back then. A lot of the decisions that were made on a daily basis were life and death decisions. So now imagine that you were in the society and you were determined to be completely unbiased. And so you leave your cave and you're going to walk through the savannah, you're going to look for food, and you're like, I am not going to make a biased decision today. And then you see an animal. It's like, I'm not going to make a conclusion about that animal. Let me consciously process everything that I see here. It has four legs. It has fur, so I'm going to conclude a mammal. It's got sharp teeth, so I'm going to say it's a predator. And it doesn't really fit my prototype for a dog or any of that. I think it's in the cat family. And yes, I think it's going to be a lion. And then you make the decision that you should probably run. Well, that set of unbiased decisions will lead us here, which is, we are going to be meat for that lion, right? So the point I'm trying to make here is that when we talk about bias, It's sometimes with this view that all of the ways that we make shortcuts in decision making and how we perceive the world is actually bad. And it's not. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it's very good and very functional, and without these shortcuts, we would not get through the day. But when it comes to people decisions, it sometimes steers us clear. Now, the world we're living in today is not filled with life and death decisions on a daily basis like it was back then, but in a lot of ways, it's a lot more complicated. So we're all in New York City. We're surrounded by literally millions of people going about their business. Even crossing the street requires algorithms. Like, we're looking at the person coming to us. Are they going to veer right? Are they going to veer left? Do I, like, have this much distance? I am entering the train, and I see one train with one car with nobody in it, and I see another car where that's just packed to the gills. Which one are you going to take? Now, logic would assume that you would go into the car with a lot of standing room, but we all know, given our experience, that we should probably avoid that car, right? So those are the kinds of decisions we're making. And bias is what's helping us make that, right? So sometimes it's good. And in fact, it's essential. Every single moment, and by moment, I'm not meaning days here or a week. I'm talking seconds. We are inundated with 11 million bits of information. And yet, consciously, we are only capable of processing 40 bits of information. So that delta from 11 million bits to 40 bits is covered by our unconscious. All of these amazingly complex heuristics and algorithms that are helping us get through the day. Absolutely fascinating. And yet now, if you step back and say, this completely functional set of biases and algorithms and heuristics, do we need to attend to them or should I just rely on them? Sometimes you should. But when we're in the workplace and we are making decisions about each other, suddenly there's pause that we have to give ourselves time to think and to reflect and try to understand how our biases are getting away from objective decision making. So we need to be able to determine, obviously, how we're going to navigate through our world and when we actually have to stop and process and when we should just go with our gut. Now, people are so much more complicated than cabs and subway rides and all that other sort of stuff. And we're not often aware of how our biases are actually already living inside of us, reinforced by culture and expressed in our behavior. So to just illustrate what biases we might have about men and about women, I'm going to take you through an exercise. This exercise is going to require a little bit of participation, so I want you to get past that New Yorkiness, and you're actually going to participate with me. So all you have to do is either raise your left hand and say left, or raise your right hand and say right. All right? You're going to see some categories come up on the screen. On your left, you see male, and on your right, you see female. Now, you're going to see a series of words come up. And if the word that comes up is associated with male, raise your left hand and say male. If it's associated with female, raise your right hand and say female. Let's give it a try. Perfect. All right. Yes, left. All right. We're going to go through this, and I'll know to advance when I hear. Right, so I'm just going to click through as soon as I hear it. All right. All right, good job. All right. Now we're going to switch things up a little bit. You're going to have different categories, and they are going to be liberal arts, left, science, right. And if you see psychology, it's a science. All right, here we go. Very good. Now we're going to make things a little bit trickier. We're actually going to cross the categories. So if you see any word that is male or science, you're going to say right. If it's female or liberal arts, you're going to say left. Got it? Here we go.
Left.
All right, good job. One last one. Can you guess what it is? We're going to cross the categories. So now, if it is male or liberal arts, you're going to say left. If it's female or science, you're going to say right. Here we go. All right, now raise your hand if you felt like that last set was harder than the ones that you had gone through previously. Okay, so almost everybody should be raising their hand. Now this is called the implicit association test. It was developed by a researcher at Harvard named Mazarin Banaji and a researcher at University of Washington named Tony Greenwald. And what they find is that over 75% of the population that takes this very same test has a faster response time when male is paired with science and female with liberal arts than when male is paired with liberal arts and female with science. And you might be thinking, well, you put that last, so I was already trained through the other one. It doesn't matter what the order is. The results are exactly the same. Now, this implicit association test was created because right around the 1980s, 1990s, the typical way of assessing stereotypes was to give you all a survey, and it had a 5-point response scale on it, and it would say something like, to what extent do you agree that women are worse at math than men? Agree, disagree. To what extent do you agree that women are better caregivers? Right? To what extent do you agree that older people are less facile with technology? Agree or disagree? Well, into the 80s and 90s, suddenly no one was agreeing with these items or disagreeing anymore, and some people concluded that we have arrived at, as a society, there is no more stereotypes, there's no more bias. But what was really happening is people were becoming more consciously aware of the kind of person they wanted to be. So they were taking that moment and they were modifying their response based on what they wanted to be true, but not what was in their head. And so these psychologists said, you know what, I think people still have exactly the same stereotypes that they had before, they just don't want to express it. So in a reaction time experiment like this, it can actually reveal your biases. And there are tests that relate to age, to race, to weight, sexual orientation, and you can take any of them for free. If you just Google implicit association test or Project Implicit, you can take any of these tests you want and you'll surprise yourself. So a lot of women would say, I wouldn't, you know, women in science would say, I would never respond more biased against women, and it doesn't matter if you're a woman, it doesn't matter if you're in technology. Those of us who are raised in a cultural context have the same associations. Doesn't matter if you're male or female or in science or in liberal arts. We all have them. Does that mean that we are all making biased decisions every second of the day? No, it doesn't. There's context that we need to be aware of. And so that's a bit bold, but you are biased, but don't worry, so am I. And it actually matters. It's not expressed all the time. When it is expressed, it's not a huge decision that you may make. Just, you're not going to say, I am not going to hire someone because she's a woman. You're going to say, I'm not going to hire someone because she doesn't seem to have the same qualifications as this next person, right? It's more subtle. And so some people have said that, okay, you've demonstrated bias. I get it. This implicit association test works. But even if it is expressed in the workplace, it would be so small as to not have any tangible effect whatsoever. And so in response, a researcher said, you know, let's see what the cumulative effect of the smallest expression of bias would have on the representation of men and women within an organization. And so he had created actually a computer simulation. In the simulation, there was a company that had 8 levels. Level 1 was the most junior level, level 8 was the most senior level. And he started the computer simulation with 50-50 men and women. So on the yellow bar here is women, the blue is men. And then he said, okay, I'm going to program 15% attrition at every single one of the levels, and the way that I'm going to fill that attrition is to pull somebody up from the level below. The way that I'm going to determine who to pull up is based on their performance score. So everybody in this computer simulation had a randomly generated performance score that ranged from about 1 to 100. But he programmed 1% of the variance in those performance scores biased against women, just 1%. So you can think of this as women receiving a performance score on anywhere from 1 to 100, and men receiving a performance score anywhere from 1 to 101. That's it. So he ran the simulation until every original member of this organization was gone and replaced by someone new, and the lowest level was always replaced at 50%. And they did it 20 times, and he averaged the results. And here's what you see. 1% of bias in performance score ends up skewing the distribution of women at the top to 35% at the very top of the organization. Tiny bias. Now, this exact same pure middle structure is what we see in corporate America. Almost any single organization you will go to, you will see a skew starting against women at the very top. Now, it doesn't mean that that is only the result of bias. There are other factors in play, but I think we would be naive to say that bias doesn't play some role in there whatsoever. So why does it matter? It matters because women have great ideas. Women can be amazing leaders. And the research is showing that when we have gender diversity at the very top of organizations, it actually drives all of the metrics that shareholders care about. Return on equity, return to shareholders, all sorts of things. It's also true that the kinds of teams that we're a part of are the ones that will benefit most from diversity. So complex decision making, innovation, these things are better when we have diversity represented than when they're not. And it's not only that having a woman in a group or an African American in a group or an older person in a group of younger people, it's not only that that person contributes something unique. Research shows that everybody else contributes something unique. So you actually act differently in a diverse group than you will in a group of people exactly like yourself. You will overemphasize the qualities that you have in common when all of you are the same, and you'll actually feel freer to express something that's different when you have different people in the group. So we have this incentive to have diversity, and yet we also know that we're inclined through our biases and through our heuristics to keep diversity at a minimum. So that is what we're trying to grapple with here at Google, and we have some suggestions for how we can overcome bias to achieve this diversity. So your job today is to commit to one action. So we're going to go through a ton of research, and we're going to have four different ways that you can combat bias. What we're starting to realize is four is a lot, and the detail in this presentation is a lot. So if you just pick one thing that resonates with you and then say to yourself, I'm going to work on that one thing, you'll actually be less biased. So don't try to do everything. Try to do the one thing. Okay, so now I'm going to go through these four different methods. And for each of them, I'm going to give a description of why it's important. I'll tell you the research that underlies the recommendation. And then I'll try to get tactical on what you can actually do to combat it. But I want to be upfront that researchers, psychologists have been very, very good at demonstrating that there is bias. If you want to get an article published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology journal, of course you all would, right? What you really need to do is design a clever experiment, show that bias can happen, but there is no incentive whatsoever to show how to get rid of it. Now, we in organizations, of course, are on the other side. It's like, okay, we know that it happens. We want to get rid of it. So we're probably the vanguard of what's going to happen in this space. So if you've got ideas on how we could actually combat it, let me know, let each other know. Here's what we've been working on over the last year. This is what we think it'll work. So we'll talk about the very, very important role that structure plays, collecting data, why that's important, evaluating subtle messages, and then finally holding everybody accountable, including yourself. So let's start with structure for success. I put this as number one because I actually think for a lot of the formal decisions that we make, this is the most important thing that we can do. And so the questions to ask ourselves are, what does success look like in the jobs that you're in? And if you're in HR, what does success look like for the roles that you're supporting? And then get specific about it. So let me tell you why this is important. There was a study that was done in 2005 from MIT researchers, and what they did was created resumes, sort of like the example I started this talk with. Half of the resumes had prototypical African-American sounding names, and half of them had prototypical European-American sounding names like Brendan, Greg, Emily, and Anne. Turns out that if you've got one of these names and you send your resume, and these were actual resumes sent to actual people looking for entry-level sales folks or administrative assistants in the Chicago and Boston metro areas, turns out if you've got those names, for every 10 resumes that you send out, you will get one callback. Exact same resume, but you have Tamika, Aisha, Rashid, or Tyrone as your first name. It requires 50% more resumes, so 15 resumes to get one callback. Exactly identical experience, same schools graduated from, actual employers making real decisions. Now, do you think it's the case that these people reviewing resumes said, I absolutely refuse to interview someone named Aisha? Probably not. More likely is the case that I've got impressions about what African Americans are like. I don't even know these consciously, but it's causing me to make different decisions than I otherwise would. How can we combat that? By knowing exactly what it takes to succeed at a job, knowing what's important to extract from a resume, and then ignoring everything else. Is your name important on a resume? Probably not. What other sorts of information is present on a resume that's probably completely irrelevant, but that people look at? Address, like where you live, for sure. Anything else? What school you went to, and this is something that we went through internally at Google. So we've got the company founded by a small set of people from a small set of schools, and for a long time we thought that actually mattered. We did our own internal research. Guess what? It doesn't matter what school you went to. It does not correlate to your actual performance, so stop looking at it, right? The other thing is the year of graduation. How many times do people look at what year did they graduate, and then they backtrack, how old must they be? How old are they relative to me, and why are they applying for a role above me when they're younger than I am, right? So we go through all of these things, and we shouldn't see anything if it doesn't add to our ability to hire the right person. So there was a study that really demonstrated this nicely, and what they did was created resumes of people who were applying for a police chief position. And there were two kinds of resumes, somebody who had street smarts and somebody who had school smarts. And so they didn't have names on the resumes, they just had the two kinds of resumes. And it turns out, by and large, people preferred the resume of the person who had school smarts over street smarts for the role of police chief. Nice, simple finding. Well, they did a second study where they actually put names. So 50% of the names were male names, 50% of the names were female names, had people go through the same exercise. Guess what? They prefer the resume with a male name on it over the one with a female name on it. And when asked what is going on here, they said, well, though she had a lot of street smarts, we really prefer somebody with school smarts. Or they said, though she had a lot of school smarts, we really prefer someone with street smarts for the role. So the subjects seriously thought that they were attending to the information on the resume, unaware that they were influenced by the gender of the applicant. And so the researchers did a third study. Before you saw any resume whatsoever, you had to say, what is more important to you? And people said, well, school smarts is important. They sent the resume, or gave them the resumes with the person's name on it. No more gender bias. If you actually articulate that school smarts is important to you, they then overlooked the gender of the candidate and made unbiased decisions. So what is the lesson for us? The lesson is that we have to articulate our expectations for the roles that we're filling. And that's really hard for us to do in the space that we're in, because a lot of us are hiring for roles that we don't know what it takes to succeed, right? So the challenge is on us to do that. But we can. We can say problem solving is the number one most important thing that we need to do, hire for. So let's define it and let's figure out what the good signals are. Or ability to influence if we are trying to get funding, for example. We can get more specific, but it's hard to do. We have been really getting more structured over the last couple of years, and we're doing that by employing a method called structured job interviews. So any candidate who comes in and interviews today at Google can rest assured that the questions that they're being asked are not the capricious questions, the brain teasers that don't actually give us the ability to predict. Instead, what has happened is we have taken pains to understand every job that we're looking to hire for at Google. We've articulated what is required to do that job well. We use that as the baseline for asking questions, so every question on our interview protocol is tied to a competence that we know that you need to have to excel. And then we make sure that if I interviewed five people for that one role, all five people have answered the exact same questions. Now, some people have rebelled, saying, that's so robotic. Why even have interviews if you're going to impose all of these structures? And the response is, all the research that's out there shows that unstructured interviews are about the worst way that you can make a hiring decision, but structured interviews significantly adds to our ability to find a good person for the job who will succeed. Now, As I mentioned, we're in a really unique space because a lot of you are in very young companies or you're starting your own companies. Do you guys know what this is? This really resonated when we talked to our Mountain View folks, but this is like the beating heart of Silicon Valley. This is a map view of Sand Hill Road in Palo Alto, which is where most venture capital companies are in Silicon Valley. And what they're doing is these venture capitalists are making bets about the future. So we don't actually see product from you yet, we see vision. And I'm going to take this very valuable money and I'm going to invest in some, but not all, of the different ideas that come across my desk. How am I going to make that decision? Now, when we think about what leads to bias, ambiguity, using our heuristics and our algorithms, this is a recipe for disaster. And actually, we can see this in action. There was a study that was done just a few months ago, actually, right? And so what the researchers did is they looked at people who were pitching over a three-year period, pitching to VC companies, and they looked at the gender of the person who was pitching. And it turns out that men who were pitching were 60% more likely to get VC funding after having done the pitch. Lest you think, if you're a man in the audience, that everything is set for you, it also helps to be a very attractive man, because attractiveness also matters a lot, right, for men. Attractiveness doesn't really matter for women whatsoever, but there is less likelihood that a pitch is going to be accepted. Now, one of the reasonable critiques of this study is that it was a natural field experiment, so is it possible that the women who were pitching were simply not as good as men were? Possible. So what the researchers did next is they actually created pitches and gave people an incentive to pick the best idea. So you had an incentive to pick the best idea. And then they wrote the pitches. Then they had a male or a female deliver the pitch. And they were coached in terms of style, tone, everything. So essentially, it was identical pitch, whether it was delivered by a man or a woman. They had a couple of different pitches, and then they gave them to subjects. And it turns out that 68% of the pitches delivered, of the pitches that were delivered, it was much more likely, 68% likely, that those delivered by a man would actually win the pitch or win the competition versus men, even though it was exactly the same pitch, right? So even under controlled environments, we're starting to see that bias. And so when you aggregate across all the different ideas being pitched out there, all the different new companies, you start to understand why we see this as the depiction of Silicon Valley companies, right? So the challenge for us, building structure and criteria, is especially difficult, so we have to try all the harder to do that. So what is it about the stereotype of men and women that might lead people to back a male versus a female? Well, one of the reasons why is because we are really looking for people who can be great leaders to be the ones whose ideas we're backing. And leader actually equals male in a lot of people's minds. And this has been verified through research. So here's a very simple study that's been done across countries and over time. And it simply involves asking people to list all the descriptors that come to mind when you think of a typical man, a typical woman, and then a typical manager. 71% of all of the words used to describe a typical man overlaps with the words used to describe a good manager. And only 10% of those words have overlap with the words people use to describe a typical woman. And so if you think about what this means, does it mean that women can't be good managers? No. It just means that in the abstract, the qualities we think men have are also naturally the qualities that we think make for good leaders. And so if I'm making an educated guess based on very little information on people who are going to lead a company, what's going to be the more comfortable guess for me to make? Well, probably that the pitch being delivered by a man is more likely to be successful in the future. So then you might also ask, well, okay, though the overlap in the stereotype isn't great, why don't women just take all of these attributes ascribed to leaders and make sure that they embody them themselves? They're going to be forceful, they're going to make decisions quickly, they're going to be self-promoting. Well, that also comes with a disadvantage because suddenly you're not very womanly anymore and people don't really like to work with you. So that is the premise, actually, of the book that Sheryl Sandberg wrote called Lean In. And so it's sort of a double bind. But we can get past that once we understand our biases. All right. Any questions about structure and criteria? All right, let us move to method number two, which is collecting data. Unless we have data and evidence that something is going awry, we're quite unlikely to actually fix it. But data can be very difficult for us to collect in the performance realm. So let me give you an example of performance. Who loves performance management and getting your annual performance review? Like nobody, right? Oh, you do. Well, I heard that about you, but I'm just kidding. So for most people, it's a very painful process. And a lot of companies these days are actually choosing not to do any performance management at all. They said that's a tired old concept, doesn't give us valuable data, and we're just not going to do it. Well, not having data actually leads us to some problems too. And here's a study that tells us why. Now, in this study, there was a man and there was a woman who were working together collectively on a task. Now, if you were a subject in the experiment, your job was to assign a performance score to each of the two people. Now, there were two conditions. Either you were told what each person contributed independently to the project that they were working on. So person A did X, Y, and Z, and person B did L, M, and N, right? Or you were told that collectively, this is what the people did. You know, I don't know who did what, but the outcome was fabulous. And then they assigned a performance score from 1 to 7. It turns out that if you had individual information, that's the top bar here, both the man and the woman were assigned a very high performance score. Actually, it was on a 9-point scale, not a 7-point scale. Great, so no bias expressed whatsoever. However, if you got the collective information, what happened in that condition is you were less likely to believe that the woman had as much influence over the outcome of the task than the man did. So what does this tell us? This tells us that the more ambiguous the data that we have about the performance a person has actually done on the job, the more biased we're likely to be when we're assigning responsibility, and that can actually lead to lower performance scores, less likely to get promoted, all sorts of bad things for your organization. Now, the challenge for us then is to say, well, what are the metrics that we can use to chart performance, and how can we make sure that's not biased? So I would advise you, do not give up on performance management. Just do it really well. Collect the data about what a person has contributed and make sure that it's based on the structure and the criteria we described before. Now, we've learned that if we don't keep track of the numbers, that others will do it for us. So we had a little public embarrassment when somebody was looking at all the Google Doodles that we had on Google.com. So if you go to our webpage, Google.com, you'll see that we celebrate the birthdays of mathematicians, scientists, and engineers. And they're always cute, and they're always, you know, sometimes interactive. We love them. Nobody was really minding the gender representation on those Google Doodles, and it turns out for every 10 birthdays celebrated of men, there was only one celebrated of women. And that actually sends a very powerful message to girls and women out there about the whether or not technology is welcoming to them. And so this was actually published, and it was a bit of an embarrassment, and now guess what? We've got much better representation, and it's become an organizational goal to have diversity represented. But if we didn't have that data point, we never would have tried to do it. And then the final thing I'll say about collecting data is that collecting data about yourself is really important. And that's why we started by having you do the implicit association test as a group. And you should continue to do some of those tests, because unless you're convinced that you can be part of the problem, you're unlikely to think of yourself as part of the solution. All right. So evaluating subtle messages is the next thing. There is this term called microaggression. Microaggression refers to the very small behavioral cues that you give to somebody about whether their contributions have been valued, whether I want to talk to you or interact with you, completely unconsciously driven, and yet they influence our behavior. Now I'm going to give you an example of how this happens. And it's an example of, it's a research project that was done at Rice University in the wonderful state of Texas in Houston. And the researcher who is doing this wanted to demonstrate that we actually interact with people who are different from us differently than we interact with people who are the same. And so she had people come into her lab and she said, I'm going to have you go out into Houston area malls and apply for a job. But before you leave my lab, I'm going to have you wear a hat. Either the hat is going to say Texan and proud, or it's going to say gay and proud. Now, they weren't told that they could be wearing that second hat. And the experiment wasn't to see if they came back alive or not. They all did. The experiment was to see, what were the interactions like when they went into the Houston area malls and applied for the job? And it turns out that the interactions were very different depending on the hat that you were wearing. The number of words used, and keep in mind these are very brief interactions. You're coming in saying, do you have any positions you're hiring for? May I have a job application? Can I fill it out? And then you say goodbye. Now, the number of words used was much greater if you were wearing the Texan and Proud hat. The interaction length was about 50% longer, and the perceived negativity, which was self-described afterwards, was much greater. It was perceived to be much more negative if you were wearing the Gay and Proud hat. And this was all communicated in a microaggression sort of way. Now, I would argue that we are doing this all the time, and we've actually seen evidence of it at Google in an interesting experiment that we ran on social networks. Now, social networking is the term that we use to describe the connections that you have to other people in the workplace. So you can imagine yourself as the red dot in this diagram, and every other dot in the diagram is another person you might work with. Every line from you to that person is a direct connection. So imagine that you have a 360-degree feedback system and your performance is evaluated. A direct connection would be anybody who evaluated your performance directly. Now, let's just say person A evaluated you. Now, person A is also evaluated by other people. Now, the people who evaluated A are your indirect connection, right? So there are two features of a social network that are really important. How many people are you connected to? And how many people are they connected to? So we actually use a version of the PageRank algorithm to generate this for us. And so we wanted to find out, what does the social network at Google look like? We did this through our annual employee opinion survey in 2012, and we asked people, list the names of five people that you go to for work-related advice. And we had 90% of the company filled it out, so almost a completely saturated social network, and it allowed us to create a beautiful graph like this. So this is actually, in social network terms, called a hairball. And if you could zoom in, these are thousands and thousands of dots and thousands of lines connecting the dots. Now, the dots are also scaled in terms of size. So if it's a really big dot, it's a really well-connected person. Now, if you were in here, where would you want to be in the social network? Here or here? A or B? B. You want to be in the middle of a social network. And that means that you're very well connected. And why do you want to be in the middle? You want to be in the middle because it means you have access to more information, you're more influential, and research also shows that your performance or your promotion trajectory will be significantly faster than somebody who's more on the periphery. Now, these are all of our engineers. Now, they're pretty tightly clustered, though you see some people who are basically talking to three people at the edge, but they're an anomaly. And it looks significantly less clustered when you actually map on our central functions like HR. All the green are like our HR people. And you can see there's some overlap, but a lot of us in HR, and this is also finance and communications, we're not really well networked with our engineers, but don't feel sorry for us because we are talking to somebody, and that is our sales Googlers. So all the red are the people who are in our sales function. And the takeaway here is that if you're in sales, you talk to salespeople. If you're in engineering, you talk to engineers. And there's a very thin layer of salespeople who actually talk to engineers. Now, is this a healthy way for an organization to run? Probably not, right? So what is the platform that our salespeople are using to sell products? Technology. Who are our technology people designing products for? Our clients, advertisers, right? So there's this incentive for us to speak across lines, and yet very few of us are doing. And that is bias at work. We interact with people who are similar to ourselves. It feels comfortable. And that is the really hard bias message, which is we need to push ourselves to do something uncomfortable, which is talk to people that you wouldn't normally talk to. The best thing you can do for yourself is, if you have the ability, move your desk from your immediate work group and sit with people who you wouldn't normally sit with. It forces connections, even if it feels uncomfortable, and even if the people around you are like, what the hell are you doing sitting in my space? But you're all in companies that are small enough that that's actually a possibility. The other thing that Google has done from the very beginning is have things like micro kitchens or common spaces where people will come and they'll intermingle. And that's been somewhat effective for us too. The power of subtle social signals is incredible. And even the way that your physical space is designed can send signals of inclusion or exclusion to those who are around you. There was a study that was done at Stanford, and what they wanted to do is see how people felt about different majors. These were undeclared majors, undergraduates. They had them come into a room in the computer science building and just fill out an interest inventory. How interested are you in history, in psychology, in Russian, in computer science? Half of the students came into a room that was decorated like what you see on the left, which is very stereotypical tech, right? It had computer paraphernalia, it had soda cans, it had gaming consoles. The other half came into an identical room, but it was decorated differently with more gender-neutral things. And what they found in the study was just because of the decor, female students were significantly less likely to say they wanted to major in computer science when they walked into this room than when they walked into that room. Men were significantly less likely to say they wanted to major in computer science when they walked into this room than when they walked into that room. And so that made us be very introspective about our physical space. What are the messages that we're sending around? And it was amazing what you see when you use this sort of lens to look at the world. One of the things that we did was looked at how we named our conference rooms. So we had a whole floor of Google that was named after scientists. But of maybe about 15, 20 conference rooms, there was only one that was named after a woman scientist. There was probably more than one woman scientist we could have named them after. So after we took a look at our physical surroundings, we actually changed a good number of them. Meaning that we have to have completely sterile environments with no creativity or individuality? No. But it does mean that we have to have diverse physical spaces, right? So if you've got a room that has a ton of video games in it, have another room that has flowers and plants, whatever. Like, just let's make sure that the messages we're sending about who's welcome here, whose contributions that we value, and who we want to stay in the long run is as open and inclusive as you think it is. All right, so the last method is to hold everyone accountable. I like to end with this one because it's, I think, equally as powerful as number one and a little bit more tangible than two and three. So what do we mean by that? Number one, you have to hold yourself accountable. Research is very clear that you can make the unconscious conscious if you give yourself a moment. So don't close on the first decision that comes to your mind, especially when you're assigning a performance score, when you're making a hiring decision, when you're trying to determine who to promote, even when you're determining who you're going to have lunch with or who you're going to sit next to, those intangible decisions. So question your first impressions, justify your decisions. So even if nobody is putting pressure on you to justify why you're going to hire person A versus person B, tell them anyway. If you're held accountable for your view, you will be less biased. If nobody will listen to you, write it down. Turns out that just writing down why you're making a decision leads to less bias. Ask for feedback. One of the things that we're telling people who come in for performance discussions is before that performance discussion with your manager is over, say, before you leave the room, let me just repeat back what I heard you say. And then you repeat it back, and you'll be amazed at what people heard. If you're a manager, before you let that other person leave the room, say, could you just tell me what you heard me say in that conversation? Give people the opportunity to point out the bias for you. That's how you hold yourself accountable. The next thing that you need to do is empower everyone to call out bias. This is so critical. I've been asked, why our unconscious bias training, this is a version of what you're seeing right now, has actually changed the culture of Google, when in so many other companies they have something very similar and it goes nowhere. The difference is, in the companies where it goes nowhere, it's treated like almost every other mandatory training, which is, you know, like managing within the law, legal compliance, things that you have to go through. But if you have a culture where people can use the new terminology and call each other out without any repercussions, you'll be amazed at what happens. Like, for example, right now, we're working very hard on having an unbiased performance management process, and people are sending emails to threads that include thousands of people saying, I think that this is a biased decision that we're making with performance management. I think we should change it. And then there's this egalitarian conversation about it. So you have to create that openness in your culture in order for these concepts to take root. And so, you know, maybe you have them do a version of this, right, as a group? All right. There are a few tangible ways that you can hold everybody accountable. Number one, as I mentioned, creating a culture of calling out bias. Number two, just as you should justify your decisions, you should make other people justify the decisions that they've made. And one way to do that is to make as many formal decisions collectively as you can. Our founders did a very smart thing at the very early days of Google, which is they said there is no single hiring manager who can make an autonomous decision about who to hire on their team. Instead, we are going to create what's called a hiring committee, and we will present the candidates in the same, all candidates have a packet that includes their resume, all the interview feedback, everything. We will discuss, and then as a group, we will determine whom we should hire. I can tell you it creates a lot of frustration trying to get consensus. Candidates get frustrated because our hiring process can be a little bit longer than what they might experience at other companies, but we have, a lot less bias through that collective decision making than we otherwise would. We use the same process for assigning performance scores, and we use the same process when we're determining whom to promote. No decision is made by an individual, and by having a collective, especially if it's a diverse collective, you will ask for different kinds of information. It will force people to come up with justifications for their rating, their hiring decision, or their promotion decision. All right, so these are the four: structure for success, collect your data, evaluate subtle messages, and hold everyone accountable. And hopefully you can find one thing in this whole presentation that you can say, this will make my company better. That's it. Thank you. If you've got questions, raise your hand, and then we'll bring the mic.
I was just wondering, when you were evaluating the bias against women, did you have data on, are women biased against women?
Yeah.
I guess is what I'm wondering.
That is a great question. I'm glad that you asked. So that very first study that I mentioned to you where college professors were rating the resume, women professors rating that resume had exactly the same magnitude of bias as men who are rating the exact same resume. Those who take the implicit association test, women have exactly the same amount of bias expressed as men do. And so it doesn't matter if you're a member of the group or not. We're all prone to it. And so one of the things that we're doing is we're telling Google employees, we're not saying men are bad and women are great and men you need to change. We're saying we're all bad and we all need to change, right? So it's very important to have that message out. And by the way, it's not just men and women. It's every kind of diversity that you can imagine, whether you went to a state school versus an elite school, what age you might be, what part of the world you might have come from, whether you have an accent of one sort or the other. Every single one of these cues elicits a stereotype. And so we just need to be aware that it can cue bias.
Is it on? Okay. I was curious, in looking at the social networking data, how you think about the advantages of a really broad social network as opposed to a really intense and deep social network?
Yeah.
And sort of what your goal is to promote within Google?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question, and I don't know that I have a good answer to it. A broad social network means that you'll more likely have access to a lot of different kinds of viewpoints and a lot of different kinds of people doing different work. And if you're an organization that is hiring for generalists and you want people to be able to do a lot of different things really well, I think that broad social network is important. It, by the way, has been foundational to Google's success to be able to have people who can draw ideas from different areas and innovate. If we had only hired people who could create the world's best email platform, we would never have been able to move beyond Gmail to other products that we might have, right? So there's this incentive to have a broad-based social network and also a broad-based knowledge base. But there are some products, there are some things that you're doing that probably would require really deep network in a specialized area, and I think that's kind of dependent on what you're working on. So for example, Google has now developed a contact lens that if you're diabetic is very important to you because you put the contact lens in and it actually reads the glucose in your blood. And then in order to activate it, you put on these glasses frames and there's a battery and it actually charges it up so that you can get a reading. It's the most amazing thing. In order for that product to get off the ground, they had to have people who specialized in making machinery very, 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 very small. They also had to have chemists and biologists. Like, these are people with really specialized skill sets. And so it was important that we had people who were very narrowly defined. But that is an anomaly in the kind of product space that we're in. And I think a lot of new companies that want to branch out from their original idea are going to have to face, having a broad-based skill set and a wide social network.
With strategy number one, structure for success, you mentioned that articulating the kind of like parameters of a good candidate and the skills that a good candidate would have help you combat that bias. Does the degree to which you articulate that, like internally, externally, detail, level, impact its effectiveness, or is it just kind of the act of doing it is good enough?
No, the more detail that you can have, the better, although there is a risk of being overly prescriptive. So the more research-backed detail that you can have, the better. So the best thing to do is to do research on people who are in the job and find out what are the characteristics that are leading them to be effective. And we've done a lot of that internal research. So when we come up with our job descriptions and what are the skills required, it's based on the profile of people who have been successful in that role. You should communicate that to candidates because it's in your best interest that people filter themselves out of the hiring process based on accurate information rather than having a net that's this huge and then you're doing all that work yourself. So there's really no disadvantage to doing that. And I thought I was going to say something else about that. I can't remember. But yeah, I would say be as detailed as the research allows you to be. And then making sure that everything is sort of mapped to that. Oh, I was going to mention one other thing. It's not just the questions that we ask in an interview protocol that's important. It's the rubric that we have for grading the answers to the questions. So when we develop a research-based interview protocol, we will actually have descriptors of what a good answer to the question is, a medium answer, and a poor answer. And so that way, it's not just a question. It's that we're ensuring that every interviewer has the same perspective of what's good and what's bad. So it's almost endless where you can apply structure if you're minded to do that.
I have a question about the employee opinion survey. Was that just that one question about who would you go to for advice? Can you talk about a couple other questions that you asked?
Oh, yeah. So we have an employee opinion survey that we call Google Geist.
Mm-hmm.
It goes out every year. It's like an event. It's like the one formal channel for Googlers to express themselves on all sorts of things. So.
Mm-hmm.
They rate their manager on a set of core attributes that we know to be important to managerial effectiveness. They're rating our culture. They're telling us how much fun they have on their job. They tell us how satisfied they are with the career development opportunities. They're rating their peers. So there's all sorts of things. And this was just one small question at the end of the survey.
So can I poke at that a little bit? So how do you ask those questions in like an engaging way rather than like, are you engaged in your job?
Some of them are more engaging questions than others. I will say sometimes you just have to ask the more boring questions, but they actually matter. For us, it's the most important thing is acting on the results. And because we take the results, we share it with the entire company. We're transparent on the results of every single question on the survey. And you can actually, as an employee, go in and cut the data by different vice presidents and functional units, and then we have a whole company-wide presentation. It almost doesn't matter if the question is boring or not. What matters is the question important to do my work or making the company better? And when leaders take action on the items, it just generates a lot of goodwill towards the survey. And we get a 90% response rate on the survey. And most surveys have a response rate of between 30 and 50%. And I think that the reason they're answering it is not because the questions themselves are particularly compelling, but because we take action on it.
Cool.
Yeah.
How do you actually word the job descriptions to attract a more diverse group of people or candidates? Because considering my own bias, when I heard that when women see a job description, they evaluate, they say, I can do this part, but, I can't do that, so maybe I shouldn't apply. Where men say, President of the United States? Yep, I can do it. I'm totally qualified. So how do you structure that, the job description, in order to get?
Yeah, I think you're pointing out something that's really challenging, and I don't think a job description is going to fix it, which is how confident do you have to be before you apply for a role? And research does indicate that women will wait on average until they meet more of the requirements to apply than men will. The most important thing you can do in a job description is only put the things on there that matter. And it gives you actually an easy filter. So even if men are more likely to apply for that role, even though they only have 3 out of 8 requirements, you can say, well, this guy only has 3 out of 8 requirements, so we're going to automatically reject the resume so that I don't put anything in the job description that's not required. So that way you can look at all the people who are required, and then you can say male or female. We are going to look for people who are meeting every one of our requirements as much as we can determine from resumes, which are not the best signal. Or if you have a structured application process, you can actually ask for the things that are important. So it's just like I wish that we could get men and women equally assertive in applying for those roles. But if we can't, let's just make sure that we're weeding out the people who put themselves forward who aren't really actually qualified for it.
Brian, that's probably a good opportunity. Talk a little bit about Alan's email to women at the promotion cycle.
Yeah, so we did our own. One of the things that we do across all of our formal people decisions is we look for any signs of bias. So we look at the pass-through rates of male and female candidates. We look at promotion rates, performance scores. Normally, we don't find differences because, as I said, we make a lot of decisions collectively, which sort of weeds out bias. But in 2010, we saw a promotion rate difference for our software engineers going from entry or from junior level to mid-level software engineers, and that's a very important promotion for people. And we saw that a smaller percentage of our female software engineers were getting promoted than men. We were like, oh my God, what's happening? So we actually looked into how we were promoting people, and it turns out you have to be nominated for promotion, and then someone has to accept your nomination. There are two ways that you can be nominated for promotion. Number one, your manager can put you up, but number two, you can nominate yourself. If you nominate yourself, you're automatically opted into the promotion review cycle. Guess what happened? Women were significantly less likely to nominate themselves for promotion. They were simply waiting longer. So take the average man and the average woman. With an equal amount of tenure and performance history, the women were less likely to nominate themselves. So we in the HR side were struggling with, like, what do we do about this? And legal got in and they said, well, you can't share it because it's evidence of bias and all this sort of stuff. So while we were all discussing, Alan Eustace, who is our SVP of knowledge, said, well, this is ridiculous. And he wrote an email to every engineer saying, we did this research. We found a promotion discrepancy between men and women. We also found that it was due to the self-nomination rates. If you have enough tenure, if you have strong performance history, put yourself forward. There's no disadvantage, even if you don't get promoted. That one email completely eradicated the difference we saw in self-nomination rates, and in that following promotion cycle, no promotion rate difference. It is now something that we do every single cycle that he sends out this email.
Admittedly, I haven't read Lean In, but maybe you have, since it's pertinent to this. I was wondering if you think the solutions proposed in that book, whatever they may be, are effective based on your research.
Yeah, so Lean In is actually, I would recommend it as something to read. Sheryl Sandberg has a lot of really interesting personal stories, but she's taken pains to back it all up with research. And so she actually cites a lot of the research that we have here. I would say that the recommendations are pretty open at this point. So as I said before, no company has solved this before. She puts forward a few premises. A lot of what she talks about is really aimed towards individual women. Like, how do you actually lean in and be assertive and be aware of the consequences of that, right? So if I'm going to lean in and say, I deserve this promotion, then how do you deal with the backlash that comes from that? Well, I mean, she's so assertive. She's so difficult to deal with, whereas a man exhibiting the same behavior might elicit a very different reaction. So she targets a lot the individual women. What we're really focused on is organizational things that we can do. So let's take the onus off women to fix this for themselves, and let's put it directly in the hands of our leaders, our HR groups, our decision-making processes. Let's put nudges in our environment to sort of combat bias institutionally, which I think is a longer-term fix. But there's a great value to lean in, which is like you as an individual woman do not have the power to change how your organization runs these processes, so what can you do? So that's the difference I would see between hers and ours. Yeah.
Is Google's goal kind of to take some of these learnings and also have other organizations like government and other corporations apply them as well, or is it mainly about, you know, fixing it here first and foremost and then seeing what happens and whatever
yeah.
Maybe?
We would love to fix Google first, obviously, because we have an obligation to our employees to have the best company in the world to work at, and equally as amazing for people of different genders and races and everything, right? But we want to take the message out. We've been hanging back a little bit because we're a very data-driven company, and we want to make sure we've actually changed things. So we're collecting a lot of data to find out if after people take the workshop, do they feel like, do they understand the concepts more? Are they changing their behavior? So everything that we're doing, we're collecting data around. And if we can show that we've had a change in people's behaviors and in the company overall, we will then share with the rest of the world. But we're not going to be one of these companies that puts forward a prospectus and say, you should do this, but don't have any data to back it up. Because I think that's actually a disservice. And there are a lot of people who are speaking, but not as many that have data to back them up. So we want to be the latter.
Yeah, if you think about the optimal class that is that receives the benefit of favorable bias, it would be the tall, attractive male that exhibits great leadership qualities, right? If you're outside of that class, does that just mean you have to work harder to bridge that gap and work harder, longer, and more efficient to get the same promotions and the same pay, that type of thing?
Yeah, it all depends on what we're talking about. So there's actually an Asian American man who wrote this, I don't know, would you call it a blog? Was it a blog, a piece that I think ran on Slate? Or it ran somewhere, and it made the rounds at Google. But he was talking about, as a young man, how much encouragement he got to go into technology and how his parents put a computer in his hands as soon as they could. And then he went to school and he said, people just assumed I was great at coding. And then he went to graduate school and he wrote about having female members of his class that were sort of relegated to the less sexy, less challenging technical problems. And he says in that piece that he wasn't particularly talented, but he definitely benefited from the stereotype of Asian American men in technology. So yet, if you would take him and put him in Harvard Business School or a business program that was training leaders, would he benefit from the stereotype there? Probably not, because it's a different stereotype, different assumptions of what it takes to succeed. So I think you always have to look at what setting you're in and what are the stereotypes about success in that setting and what social groups sort of map onto it, right? So there's this interesting study that was done on stereotype threat. Stereotype threat is when you think other people have negative expectations of how well you're going to perform at a task. It actually causes anxiety and it impedes your performance. So if I have a math test and then I have a group of men and women and I say, okay, you're going to do this math test, and there have been gender differences in the past, so we expect it here. Guess what? Women don't perform as well. But if you say, this is a test, and no gender differences, you just sort of prime them, men and women don't actually perform differently. So Claude Steele is the name of the researcher at Stanford who's done a lot of this, and he had another task which was physical prowess. And so he had people actually golfing, and then if he described the task as evidence of your physical ability, African American students actually outperformed whites. And then if he described the task as a strategy task, then whites outperformed the African Americans, right? So it's very complicated how these things get expressed.
Okay, well, I want to thank you all so much for coming, and particularly I want to thank you, Brian. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks.